Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Dean and Chapter, a very warm welcome to Westminster Abbey for this first lecture in a series celebrating the 400th anniversary of the King James Version of the Bible. The series is part of a wider programme of lectures in the Abbey in the autumn and the spring, which explore issues of faith and society from both historical and theological perspectives. We hope these may be of interest too, and you will find on your seat a programme of those events. And if you would like to take those programmes away with you, please do. If you would like advance notice of these and similar events in the future, there's also a form on your seat with the opportunity for you to give contact details. Please do fill them in, leave that on your seat, and they'll be collected later. But now to this first series of lectures, series co-sponsored with Theos. The inspiration for them is, of course, the extraordinary text of the King James Version of the Bible, which has brought such an extraordinary richness and had such resonance across the centuries, and in fact has brought us together here tonight, and so many of us. Very fittingly, of course, in this place, since it was here in the Jerusalem chamber of the Abbey 400 years ago, that one of the three groups working on the translation met. Its impact, first and foremost, is as a religious text. There's no doubt about that. For Christians, the Bible is something above all which mediates the mind and purposes of God, but also always interwoven with its religious significance. It has had this huge cultural, social, and political effect in the life of this country and other English-speaking countries. The first lecture tonight will be given by Lord Judge, Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales, Head of the Judiciary and President of the Courts of England and Wales. Lord Judge was Senior Presiding Judge for England and Wales from 1998. He was appointed as the first President of the Queen's Bench Division in 2005 and Head of Criminal Justice in 2007. He became Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales in 2008, when he was also made a life peer. He's been awarded an honorary doctorate from Nottingham Trent University, made an honorary fellow of Aberystwyth University, as well as Kingston University. Lord Judge is going to be lecturing on the historic and legal context of the King James Bible, the relationship between the king, the rule of law, the church, and the constitution at the time of its translation. This will lay a vital foundation, of course, for the subsequent lectures, which will then look at its continuing impact right the way through to the present, in all the ways I've just described. So, we're delighted and honoured to welcome Lord Judge to speak now on the lawyer's perspective.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's obvious from the number of you who are here that this is rather special. It's a wonderful anniversary. 400 years have gone by. But before I come to address the ferment of legal and constitutional issues which were being played out here in the heart of Westminster, contemporaneously with the translation of the Authorized Version, not only at Oxford and Cambridge, but here in the Jerusalem Chamber, perhaps I may be allowed to repeat a point that I've made before, and to do so at the beginning of this series of lectures. The men, and of course it always was men, the men involved in the task of translating the Bible believed that they were translating the Word of God into English. The precise meaning of every word mattered. Without precision, as T.S. Eliot tells us, the words would decay, slip, slide, perish. For the Word of God, that simply could not be. As you all appreciate, precision of language matters in any legal contract. But this was infinitely more important than that. This was about the immortal soul and the destiny of the immortal soul. People believed that. It was not a secular age. Ever since 1517, when Martin Luther had pinned his 95 theses onto the door of the church at Wittenberg Castle, men and women had died horrible, agonizing deaths. Because of endless disputes about whether, in his letter to the Romans, St. Paul was saying that salvation could be achieved through faith, or through faith alone, exclusively through faith. But if faith alone, where stood charity, the greatest of the great trilogy of faith, hope, and charity? And if we were predestined, and the destiny of our immortal souls was already fixed at birth, did we have free will? In the discussion at Hampton Court on this very subject, it is recorded that the king himself wished that this doctrine should be handled, this is the word recorded, tenderly. How many deaths followed the doctrinal dispute whether what happened in the sacrifice at the altar was consubstantiation or transubstantiation? Christendom is divided on this question to this day. Was it necessary for a priest or bishop, or in particular the Pope, to intervene in any respect in the relationship between each immortal soul and his or her God? Men and women endured martyrdom over questions like these, not just here in London, but all over Christian Europe. To find the answers, they sought inspiration from the Bible, the Word of God. No wonder the precise meaning of each word in the Bible mattered. And if I may say so, and this is not my subject, so I say it with proper humility. Unless we understand the religious context of the authorized version, the King James Bible, we have missed the real point that mattered to those who produced it. So I pause for a moment just for us to reflect on that. No wonder it took 7 years to produce. At just the time when Lancelot Andrews and his team, I'm sorry to use that phrase for such a distinguished group of scholars, they were working, striving to make the Bible shine more brightly, being rubbed and polished, side by side, simultaneously, with this mammoth task, a longer struggle was in the making. The results on our legal and constitutional affairs are with us to this day, and they have crossed the seas to continents which were then unexplored or undiscovered. Between 1604 and 1611, and the years which followed, although this was not the sort of language used in those days, our constitutional arrangements were examined, discussed, argued, and eventually fought over. They culminated in the public trial of the king. We always think of Charles I and his dignity on that cold January day in 1649. Our image of him is cloaked in the story of his death and the dignity with which he met it. We should not be grudging in our respect and admiration. At his trial, the king argued that the court had no jurisdiction to try him. Legally, the point was seriously arguable. What was the lawful authority which permitted the anointed king to be put on trial? The answer given was that the Commons of England, assembled in Parliament, had constituted this court. Whatever the inaccuracies in the assertion, it encapsulated the issue which had divided the country for nearly half a century. After the king was convicted and came to be sentenced, in his sentencing remarks, as we now know, as we now call them, Bradshaw, the president, told him that at one blow you had confounded the liberties and the property of England. So the king was executed, and some 40 years or so later, in 1688, his son James II was in effect removed from the throne. None of this was even in remote contemplation when Elizabeth I died in 1603 after a reign of 44 years. She was a lonely, companionless old woman. Her glory had gone, her achievements had faded in the public memory. They didn't think of her then as we think of her now. The preparation of the defences against a succession of armadas, the Armada of 1588 is the only one which we remember now, but there was more than one, together with an unsuccessful campaign in Ireland and some shocking harvests, had left the country impoverished. Her great speech at Tilbury was for the ages, but the speech illustrates something of her ability to understand and to convey to her subjects that she understood their concerns. And as a judge, I'd like to point this out to you. It's a remarkable piece of advocacy. We all know it, or some of it, but I can't resist a quotation. Consider the beginning. "My loving people, we have been persuaded by some that are careful of our safety to take heed how we commit ourselves to armed multitudes." Notice here the royal "we" and "ourselves." This was the anointed monarch speaking to her subjects. The speech could have gone on in this same way, conveying the same message, but if it had, it would have lacked the inspirational quality which arose when she personalized her leadership. "And therefore I am come amongst you, as you see at this time, not for my recreation and disport, but being resolved, in the midst and heat of the battle, to live or die amongst you all, to lay down for my God, and for my kingdom, and for my people, my honour and my blood, even in the dust." This is sublime advocacy. The "we" had become "I," and "our" had become "my." Notice how her use of "I" was a message of inclusivity, universality, "my people." In effect, they were all in it together. In this moment of national emergency, she was both the crowned queen and a flesh and blood human being, like all her subjects, with a weak and feeble body, but, as she said, with the heart and stomach of a king. And advocacy for her time led her to add, "and a king of England too." I cannot help allowing myself to imagine that her shadow was hovering above Winston Churchill when he inspired the nation in the dark days of 1940. Now, this knack, this instinctive grasp of the politically possible, never deserted her, even when her parliaments became difficult, as they did, even when she imprisoned members for discussing the succession or the role, if any, to be played by bishops. She agreed to liberal, but not licentious speech, liberty, but with due limitation. Now, to an audience today, we'd be inclined to deride the concept of any limitations. But in 16th century Europe, this was an astonishing concession to be made by any monarch. This was the century of Thomas Hobbes. The Cortes in Spain and the Parlement in France were fast withering away. Parliament, our Parliament, was, she said, the body of the realm. And when, after a heated debate in 1593, a subsidy was voted, she addressed the Commons personally saying, and it had been a long, tough parliamentary battle, "The subsidy you give me, I accept, thankfully, if you will give me your goodwill with it. If the necessity of the time of your preservations did not require it, I would refuse it." But it was now 1603. All that had gone. James I came to the throne of England and he was greeted with universal jubilation. It's unfair to say that he was all things to all men, but all men believed that the arrival of the new king would give them something. Yet he had already written his True Law of Free Monarchies. His opinion was unequivocal. Kings were the authors and makers of the laws, and not the laws of the kings. There were kings before there was law. The king was created by God to sit on his throne and rule over other men. Subjects must never rebel, and even when oppressed by Nero, should endure without resistance, but by sobs and tears to God. Obviously, this was a very different king to Elizabeth, with a very different approach to the role of monarch. Although he had declared his position, everyone was thrilled. Everyone. Perhaps they did not understand what he had written or appreciate how deeply he believed it. Perhaps, however, and can we always remember that we're talking about people? When we talk about history, we're talking about fellow human beings who lived however long ago it was that we're talking about. Perhaps, however, the fact of a safe and peaceful succession had relieved the uncertainty in the mind of virtually everybody who was not involved in the careful preparation for the succession, and therefore clouded judgment. And no one was later to remind the king that his divine right to rule meant that God had vested the arrangements for the succession to the throne of England in the hands of a somewhat surprising agent of the heavens, one Robert Cecil. The new king was generous, immensely generous. It did not occur to anyone that he was generous with what nowadays would be called the national assets. He spent money he did not have. Perhaps things do not change very much. And just as today, with the change of government, he was allowed a honeymoon period. I'm told, or I've read, that that was his word. The previous regime was gone. The new regime was exciting and vibrant. For example, the king created an endless stream of knights, so much so that it began to be said that it was better to be a gentleman than a knight because knights had become so common. Francis Bacon, who was happy enough to accept his knighthood at a mass investiture of some 300 knights, recorded that the title of knighthood was almost prostituted. In the first year alone, 1,000 knights were created. More knights than Elizabeth had created in her entire 44-year reign. And later, James created the new title of baronet. I'm sorry to say this to those of you who happen to be successors to baronetcies. It was not a mark of distinction or honour. All that was needed to be granted this hereditary title was the simple ability to be able to afford to pay. Now, in all this glamour and excitement, there was one incident which astounded even those observing events in the honeymoon period. On his way to London at Newark, James summarily ordered that a thief should be hanged without any trial or hearing. John Harrington was one of Elizabeth's many godsons, very interesting writer, but he was also, I hope the Dean will forgive me, just touching on this, he was the man who had the distinction of inventing the water closet system. It wasn't very popular at the time. Elizabeth herself thought it made rather a lot of noise and therefore disclosed where one had been, and one didn't want to know, other people to know, where one had been. But anyway, he was a surprising handyman, but he made this well-known observation. I hear our new king hath hanged one man before he was tried. 'Tis strangely done. Now if the wind bloweth thus, why may not a man be tried before he hath offended? It is immensely pleasing to me, and I hope to you, that coming down the centuries to us, such a question was being raised in this country 400 years ago. How can a man be sentenced without a trial? The idea was preposterous. If this incident had happened when the honeymoon was over, it would have been more widely condemned. And so to the great conference at Hampton Court. In the course of the discussions, the king learned what Puritans thought of his responsibilities as the supreme governor in causes ecclesiastical. I'm quoting, "If you aim at a Scotch presbytery, it agreeth as well with monarchy as God with the devil. Then Jack and Tom and Will and Dick shall meet and censor me and my council. I know what would become of my supremacy, for no bishop, no king." As Adam Nicholson explains in his wonderful readable, The Power and the Glory, which is the story, I'm quoting, "The beauty of the Church of England, with its full panoply of bishops and archbishops, was its explicit acceptance of the king as at its head. But a king without bishops, subject to a presbytery, was always in danger of being removed." The discussions went on, and during them an issue was raised whether the cross should be present in baptism. This was followed by the further question, "How far the ordinance of the church bindeth without impeaching Christian liberty?" The response of the monarch to the suggestion that every man is to be left to his own liberty was stark. "I will have none of that. I will have one doctrine, one discipline, one religion in substance and in ceremony." In other words, in accordance with the Peace of Augsburg some 50 years earlier, cuius regio, eius religio, which meant that the man who ruled the country could dictate its religion to his subjects, or as the French expressed it, un roi, une loi, une foi. So to his first Parliament of 1604, James declared in Parliament that a righteous king was ordained for his people and not his people for him. But he was given a very simple message and he never really took notice of it. Don't take the commons for granted. I better not make the comment that sprang to my mind. It's not in my text. It might be an inappropriate thing to say. But don't take the commons for granted. The commons refused to rubber stamp his agreement that now that there were two kings of Scotland and England united, he was the Emperor of Britain. And then he should adopt the title of King of Great Britain by proclamation. Now, in essence, the argument was simple. On one view, allegiance to the king was a personal matter between the subject and his monarch. The contrary view maintained in the Commons was that allegiance was owed not to the person of the individual king, but to the crown and the law. Probably with Robert Cecil's advice, the king did not pursue the point further at that stage, but it was a warning. He did later partially succeed in the course of Calvin's case, when the court was persuaded that a man born in Scotland after his accession was a natural subject of the king and thus could hold land in England of which James was the king. So the divines went off to produce the authorized version, and then came the gunpowder plot, which demonstrated once and for all to the public mind that two religions could not live together. Of course, the plot represented a direct physical threat both to the king and to the members of both houses, and for a while, perhaps, the fact that they had all been subject to those same dreadful risks obscured the potential for difficulties between them. But now we're coming to the heart of it. In 1606, Sir Edward Coke was appointed Chief Justice of the Common Pleas. It's worth emphasizing, at this stage, that he had, among many other different aspects to his life, been a commons man, and indeed its speaker. The motto he displayed on his rings was significant, Lex est tutissima Cassis, that is, the law is the safest shield. Contrast this with James himself writing shortly afterwards, in 1607, that before any parliaments or laws made, there were kings. He was very rude about Parliament. Parliaments were a trial, laid on by the Almighty as plagues were laid on by pharaohs. He did not need to be rude about judges. Judges only held office for as long as they behaved themselves. That is, of course, for as long as the king thought they were behaving themselves. In his judgment, in Calvin's case, his Lord Chancellor had asserted, Lex est rex loquens, the law is the king speaking. And in the dispute in the Privy Council between the judges and the bishops, to which I will come, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Bancroft, asserted, judges are but delegates under the king. There's not much room in this analysis for an independent judiciary. Edward Coke, however, consistent with the motto on his rings, asserted, the king is under God and the law, and that the common law hath had measured the king's prerogative. In their different ways, these observations encapsulated the burning issue. Was the king above the law or subject to it? James himself had no doubt. In 1609, he told Parliament that the monarchy is the supremest thing on earth. No room there for the supremacy of the law. Even God himself spoke of kings as gods. Throughout the declamation, he described the laws as my laws, adding that never king was in all his time more careful to have laws duly observed than I. You may remember the beginning. I did ask you to notice the way Elizabeth had personalized herself in her speech at Tilbury. On this occasion, James personalized himself. But in his eye, his claim was not all-embracing, all-encompassing. This was divisiveness, separation. And he asserted a claim that, just like God, kings had power to, I quote, judge all and to be judged or accountable to none. Again, no doubt about that message. Elizabeth would have appreciated how tactless and confrontational and ultimately provocative, such sermonizing from the royal throne in Parliament would have been. In her entire reign, she had never sat in judgment or claimed to do so. If she had done so, one wonders whether it would have been questioned, but she never did. But, ladies and gentlemen, to acquiesce in the idea that the king could sit as a judge in accordance with his claim allowed legitimacy for his further observation that he was accountable to no one. The honeymoon was over. In the Commons, the king's loving subjects perceived that their common and ancient right and liberty had much declined and had been infringed in these late years. This was not a trumpet sounding a charge to battle. It was, if I may use a different analogy, it was not the full verdi. That lay ahead with the Petition of Right in 1628, one of the great constitutional documents of our so-called unwritten constitution. Rather, this was a delicate tune, perhaps written by Haydn, utterly compelling to those with ears to hear. But James was not listening. So while Lancelot Andrews and his team were beavering away, an immensely serious issue arose between the common law courts and the Ecclesiastical High Commission. The commission actually represented long-established principles that the church should govern in matters spiritual and clerical. In one sense, the problems which arose were encapsulated in the name. The commission was now calling itself the Court of High Commission. The question was whether it was a court at all. And although the issues were extremely complex, and this brief summary cannot do justice to the refinements of the argument, what brought the dispute to a head was that personal inquiries about troublesome areas of conscience in question of religion were no longer being directed at Catholics, who by virtue of any loyalty to the Pope were regarded as potential traitors in any event. The word papist was never intended as a compliment, but also to Protestant and nonconformists whose loyalty to the king was not diminished by possible loyalty to any external authority. The court asserted that it was entitled to examine nonconformists on their oath about their beliefs. Parliament challenged this claim for jurisdiction. The Court of Common Pleas asserted that a man should not be examined on his private beliefs. We take that principle for granted now, but this was a new declaration. What is more, Common Pleas added that the ecclesiastical court, if it was a court at all, was not entitled to exercise any jurisdiction in lay as opposed to ecclesiastical matters. And so, when the Court of High Commission exercised what it believed was its jurisdiction in circumstances which Common Pleas regarded as an improper exercise, orders of prohibition were issued. In our secular age, it is difficult to comprehend the importance of these questions to contemporaries of Lancelot Andrews. If this dispute happened with the modern facilities, can you imagine the collection of reporters who would be standing outside the Royal Courts of Justice, or, for that matter, and perhaps more important, the Supreme Court just over the road? The situation was complicated in the public eye, at any rate, when a barrister called Nick Fuller, appearing on behalf of Puritans who were trying to avoid fines for non-conforming, made an extraordinary series of submissions. Bishops were popish, an allegation that was close to treason, and one which would have had Lancelot Andrews surging forward out of this abbey straight into Westminster Hall, just over the way there, in a volcanic explosion. Fuller went on that bishops were under the jurisdiction of Antichrist. I'm sorry, Dean, that I'm telling you what a barrister once said about bishops. It's not intended to be personal. What's more, bishops embezzle the fines paid by nonconformists. Well, faced with that, marginally provocative, it's unsurprising that the court locked him up for contempt. Isn't it strange, strange to me at any rate, how counsel then as now did not always appreciate when there are occasions when the rapier is a much more powerful weapon than the bludgeon. Common Pleas issued a prohibition on the basis that the barrister's conduct in any court was a lay matter to be tried at common law. Bancroft asserted the contrary. Fuller was imprisoned. The case was discussed in Parliament. The Commons took Fuller's side. The ecclesiastical court did not have the power to imprison. This was seen by James as an attack on his supremacy over the church. And ponder this for a moment. In essence, if the authority of the ecclesiastical court was challenged, was criticized, then by implication at any rate, the king as head of the church was also being criticized. More important, his supremacy was being criticized. This had what we would call political implications. And it's easily identified. If there was no equivocation about the king's supremacy in matters of religion, his supremacy on secular matters would follow ineluctably. We must leave Nick Fuller. He did get out of prison. But the upshot of the widespread use in the common law courts of prohibitions to curb the powers of the ecclesiastical court and the response of the commons led to a meeting of the Privy Council to which the judges and bishops were summoned. This is real. This really happened. The king sat to decide the argument. What on earth was he doing? It was not merely that Elizabeth had never sat in judgment. A great 15th century Chief Justice Fortescue declared in his praise of the laws of England that it was not customary for the kings of England to sit in court or pronounce judgment themselves. So that's the judge deciding judges against bishops. The mind boggles. The real issue, though, was the position of the head of the Church of England, the king, who was the judge. The meeting was tumultuous. I'll encapsulate it for you. The judges made a simple point. Ecclesiastical courts have jurisdiction over ecclesiastical but not temporal measures. I'm sorry, not temporal issues. Easy. When a temporal issue arose, it must be transferred to the common law courts. The king interrupted. Patience was not one of his qualities, and he knew the answer that he was going to come to anyway. It was contended before him that the judges were but delegates of the king, and the king may take what causes he shall please from the determination of the judges, and may determine them himself. Unsurprisingly, Bancroft agreed. This was clear in divinity, that such authority belongs to the king by the word of God. Louis XIV himself could not have put the matter more clearly. Cook asserted, the king in his own person cannot adjudge any case. Cases ought to be determined and adjudged in some court of justice according to the law and custom of England. It really is difficult for us to appreciate the seriousness of the argument and what was at stake. We have to think about it. The potential consequences for Cook, when the king told the Chief Justice that he spoke foolishly. All right, that was insult enough. But worse was to come. The potential consequences, Cook was not yet beaten. He said, the laws and customs of England protected His Majesty in safety and peace. The king was even more offended. If that was right, it would mean, said the king, that the king was under the law, which it is treason to affirm. Cook replied with a quotation from Bracton, a medieval legal philosopher who had written the laws and customs of England, that the king should not be under any man, sed sub Deo et lege, under God and the law. Contemporary records tell us that in his fury the king raised his fist and shook it at Cook. Now there's an aspect to this. I don't remember any modern judges doing that. But when we just pause to reflect on it, what a moment. What a moment. There's some uncertainty whether Cook fell flat on his face or to his knees, but at the very least he knelt down. The tower beckoned. No one knew better than Cook how little evidence was required to prove treason or how a traitor was executed. For now the debate was over. The debate as a debate was over. Cook was not deprived of his office. That came later. So did his period of imprisonment in the Tower. What is remarkable is the courage involved in the issue on the following day of a new prohibition out of the common law courts against the Court of High Commission. The Commons were concerned about another matter, the use of a royal proclamation issued after the assassination of Henry IV of France in May 1610, which had required every subject to take an oath of allegiance. Look at it from the king's point of view. The assassination of his fellow king, it was said that when he heard the news, he went absolutely white. And some of us would just remember what a ghastly start he had in life, given what happened to his mother's secretary when she was very heavily pregnant with him. The assassination of his fellow king was what we would now describe as a terrorist situation, demanding to be addressed urgently by the exercise of the widest possible powers. At such times, as we know to this day, the argument for public safety is very attractive. But even the tyrannical Henry VIII had not asserted the right to rule by proclamation, at any rate without the express sanction of Parliament, which was given in 1539 in the notorious Act of Proclamations. But this act was repealed on his death and has never been renewed, although the tendency to govern by proclamation has, or the tendency to vest powers in the government of the day to do so, we call them Henry VIII clauses, has certainly come under increased use in our own country in recent years. I shall not go through or repeat what I've said on a previous occasion about the number of Henry VIII clauses which can be found in our modern statutes. But let me return to the Commons in 1610. The Commons presented an address to the King. The language was courteous but unequivocal. Different forms of proclamation were identified. For us, perhaps the most interesting complaints were directed against proclamations made shortly after the session of Parliament in relation to, I quote, matter directly rejected in the same session. It is obvious, is it not, that if the King could by proclamation in effect set aside the decision of Parliament, what was the point of Parliament at all? The address turned to other forms of proclamation, appointing punishment to be inflicted before lawful trial and conviction. Perhaps a reference to the mindset of a king who was prepared to hang the thief at Newark before a trial. And then the other proclamations which I want to highlight of which complaint was made were those referring punishment of offenders to courts of arbitrary discretion, a complaint against the absence of what we would, I think, describe as due process. James summoned the judges before him again so that he could consult whether the power to issue such proclamations was or was not vested in him. This was the moment when judges were supposed to do what the king expected them to do, their duty. He knew what the answer should be, so did his Lord Chancellor. Without the power to issue proclamations that had effect, James suggested that the king would be no better than, I quite like this, no better than a mere Duke of Venice. Cook asked for time for thought. That was a rather wise move. But he did express his preliminary view that without Parliament, the king could not change any part of the common law or create any offence that had not been an offence before. After an adjournment, the judges expressed the view that the king could not alter the law by proclamation. Such proclamations did not form part of the law of England. Then more boldly, they added, the king hath no prerogative but that which the law of the land allows him. This is mighty stuff, ladies and gentlemen. In other words, the concerns expressed by the Commons were, in the view of the judges, entirely justified. Perhaps it was just as well that when this view was expressed, James himself was out hunting in the country. He did hunt rather a lot. There are perhaps two or three significant points to notice here. First, that the Commons and the judges led by Edward Coke were making common cause. The Commons was filled with lawyers or those who had been trained at the Inns of Court. And we can't overlook the physical proximity of the Commons to the courts, which in those days all sat in Westminster Hall. That meant there was ample time for gossip and discussion among them all. Cook, in particular, as I said, was a Commons man. He'd been one, and after he was deprived of office, he resumed his role as a Commons man. And all these events I'm describing, all of them happened in this very small, tight geographical area, say, a mile radius from where I am standing, even as I speak to you today. Imagine those days. Gosh, even before the telephone, the gossip, the chat, the way in which what we now describe as public opinion was being formed. Second, Cook was extremely troubled about, and together with the judges, asked that the king and council should not constantly summon the judges to express views about issues which might arise for decision in court. The point eventually struck home, but not before a different device was tried. After the authorized version was published in 1615, poor old Mr. Peacham was charged with treason. His house had been broken into. His papers had been searched. A draft sermon, a draft which had never been preached, was found, and in it he was writing down a suggestion that there are circumstances in which a subject became entitled to reduce his sovereign if the sovereign sought to reduce his liberties. This did not look like a very strong case, unspoken words written on a piece of paper. So the papers were sent to Cook, in effect, to obtain an opinion from him in advance of the proceedings, which Cook would have presided over. It is reported that Cook used words more vehement. I'd love to know what they were, but he used words more vehement than the writer dared to repeat, that this taking of judicial opinions one by one was new and dangerous, and so it was, and so it would be to this day. Third, on behalf of my judicial colleagues, perhaps I'm allowed to say this. When James tried his hand as a judge, he summarized how difficult the exercise of our responsibilities can be. The problem he identified was that you had to listen to both sides, fairly elementary part of the judicial function. He said this, "I could get on very well hearing one side only, but when both sides have been heard, by my soul, I know not which is right." In the absence of the king, the Privy Council accepted the view of the judges that the king could not, by proclamation, create an offence which had not been an offence before the proclamation, and that his proclamations form no part of the law of England. The king himself did not raise the point again. It was a victory of the greatest possible importance to our constitutional developments. Without it, without being overdramatic, our Parliament would have gone the way of the Cortes and the Parlement in France. I must now come to a piece of litigation. In 1610, the famous decision in Bonham's case was reached. Bonham was a doctor, practiced medicine without a certificate from the Royal College of Physicians. The college was entitled by the Statute of Incorporation to, I quote, "regulate all London physicians and punish infractions with fine and imprisonment." Well, Bonham was guilty. He was arrested and put into prison. He brought an action for false imprisonment. He must have had a very optimistic lawyer to advise him, but anyway, the college was bound to win, wasn't it? There was the statute. But somebody noticed a problem. Half of any fine imposed by the college would be paid by the college. So Bonham won. The main reason for his victory was the common law maxim derived from Roman law, which continues to this date: no man should be a judge in his own cause. The college was party to the case and judge of it, and the beneficiary of any conviction and fine. The court said this was unacceptable. The statute, which was regulatory only, was insufficient to bypass the essential principle. So far, so good, and that should have been the end of the case. The historic interest of Bonham's case arose from an observation, which was but a discarding comment by Cook, that the common law was entitled to control an act of Parliament if such an act was against, I'm quoting, "common right and reason, or repugnant or impossible to be performed." For all the subsequent publicity and importance attached to this comment, At the time when it was made, it attracted no particular interest. It was a throwaway line, obiter dictum, we call it, not relevant to the case. Obiter dictum can be translated another way, a judicial whimsy. Well, judges shouldn't indulge in whimsicalities. But that's what it was. Cook thought nothing of it, nor did his contemporaries, nor most important of all did Parliament, and as I told you, the observation was handed down in Westminster Hall adjacent to Parliament. Perhaps more important, Cook would never have imagined for a moment that Parliament was capable of passing an act which was against common right and reason. From his point of view, the concept was a contradiction in terms. Again, a whimsy just entered my head, but I'm not going to articulate it in this company. Now, nevertheless, notwithstanding years of scorn poured on the observation by subsequent chief justices and courts, their time for this whimsical obiter dictum was to come. Go forward 150 years. The Stamp Act of 1765 was passed in Parliament. The Massachusetts Assembly declared that the Act was invalid because it was against Magna Carta and the natural rights of Englishmen, and they believed themselves then to be Englishmen, and therefore, according to Lord Cook, null and void. John Adams, the second president, one of the founding fathers of what we now call the United States of America, expressed himself determined to die of the opinion that acts of Parliament could be null. Ladies and gentlemen, there is here a crucial point. In our constitutional arrangements, the sovereignty of Parliament remains the essential principle. Now, this is me with my own theory. It was through the parliamentary processes that our constitutional arrangements were discussed, argued, and eventually established. The absolutism of a monarch was curbed by the authority and power vested in Parliament. For the colonists, the problem was Parliament itself. And in the Stamp Act, it was enacting legislation which took away the liberties which had successfully been established by Parliament here in the previous century. May I emphasize something else? We're in this very tight period of 7 years. Bonham's case was decided while the authorized version was being translated, and while it was being translated a year or two earlier, in 1606, the charter for the new colony in Virginia was settled. This was effectively drafted by Edwin Sands, a barrister, a commons man, who, like Cook, I'm going to give you a roll call, who, like Cook and Eliot and Valentine and Hollis, all commons men to whom, with many others, we are indebted for our liberties, ended up in the Tower. But in 1618, Sands wrote and was granted the Great Charter for Virginia, and by this charter, the settlers and any of the children born in the new colony and plantations were to have, quote, and enjoy all liberties, franchises, and immunities to all intents and purposes, as if they had been abiding and born within this our realm of England. The charter provided guarantees of self-government, freedom of speech, equality before the law, and trial by jury. These were all believed to be principles applicable in England, or at any rate, when Sands declared them to be established, they were at least on the aspirational agenda. They were transported across the language, and the language of this charter was repeated after colony was established, from Maryland in 1632 all the way to Massachusetts Bay in 1691. This is a moment of the greatest possible importance to the eventual widening of the common law world. When the colonists in the United States were arguing their case in 1776 for no taxation without representation, they were simply echoing what they believed were the constitutional rights which had been established in the mother country, as they called it then. For what it's worth, and it doesn't matter at all, I think they were right. And that message was carried by young Thomas Wentworth. Born in a convict ship on the way to Australia, can you imagine what his mother went through? The first man to describe himself as a native of Australia, who, from studying the way in which the colonies in the United States had established their independence, foresaw that one day the same common law principles would be established in Australia. So Cook's dictum in Bonham's case, his judicial whimsy, if you like, was much more influential in the United States than it ever was in this jurisdiction. Its significance was not appreciated while the authorized version was being translated, and as to the Charter of Virginia, it hardly merited any attention at all when that new colony was settled. But the constitutional arrangements for the new United States after the War of Independence was won gave to their Supreme Court authority over the Constitution, which our House of Lords, now Supreme Court, does not have. In this jurisdiction, the sovereignty of Parliament remains the essential principle. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you may think I've digressed, and maybe I have, but only in this limited sense. I've sought to highlight the tiny judicial acorn discarded onto apparently stony ground while the authorized version was being translated, from which a mighty oak was to grow. Let me return briefly to 1611. The authorized version was produced. It was to have its own glorious history. Others in this series of lectures will speak of all that. My thesis is that while the work was being done by Lancelot Andrews and the team, issues of the greatest importance to what we now call constitutional matters were in full flow. It's worth perhaps emphasizing, because of the way in which history actually happened, and those of us who look at history and look back on it think everything was inevitable because it did happen, when it never is inevitable, nothing's inevitable, it happens. In 1611, the overwhelming majority of the commons and the judges and the lawyers, everybody, believed in the monarchy. One of the legal scholars, John Selden, another man incarcerated in the Tower, made the simple point that a king is a thing men have made for their own sakes, for quietness' sake. The wonderful pugnation, maybe he wasn't a chap you'd want to spend your evenings with, but the wonderful pugnacious John Eliot, made of more heroic clay than Selden, who was to die in the Tower, was to say later, if false glasses did not stand between us and the king, our privileges and his prerogative might both have been enjoyed. As I've said before, though, James was not a great listener. This is symbolized in the Star Chamber in 1616, when before a large crowd of lawyers and parliamentarians, he went on, kings are properly judges, and judgment properly belongs to them from God. Kings sit in the throne of God, whence all judgment is derived. There's something suggesting that he's really getting, not merely above everybody else on earth, but getting quite close to the Almighty in heaven. It is presumption and high contempt in the subject to dispute what a king can do, or say that a king cannot do this or that. He ordered them not to meddle with things against the king's prerogative or honour, adding that if judges permitted these matters to be argued, then those who argue it and the judges who allow it to be argued would suffer. It was increasingly difficult to find an acceptable compromise, and the clash of views continued unabated. Let me encapsulate it. The king asserted that parliamentary privilege derived from the grace and commission of our ancestors and us, for most of them grow from precedents, which shows rather a toleration than inheritance. On the other hand, in the Commons, the counter-contention was this. The privileges of this house is the nurse and life of all our laws, the subject's best inheritance. When the king says he cannot allow our liberties of right, this strikes at the root. And so, ladies and gentlemen, it's all in your history books. The protest, the king tearing it out of the records, the accession of Charles I. I've mentioned the dignity of Charles at his death, and as I said, we must not begrudge that. But if James was a poor listener, Charles was utterly deaf. And one has to add this, notwithstanding his dignity at the moment of his death, profoundly devious. Then came a series of issues, the prison petition of right, the imprisonment of the five knights, the release, the long period when there was no parliament, and then worst of all wars, the Civil War. Anyone who troubles to read about these events and the way they unfolded and pauses for a moment to remember that the history book which is being read is telling the story of real people, real individuals, facing immensely difficult problems of conscience and opportunity, subject to all the frailties and concerns that people have today, could never believe that history is boring. Once the monumental task of completing the authorized version was over and it was published, that was an end of it. It was an end of the work. It was the beginning of another journey of the Bible across the world. And the English language too. But that's not for me. Alongside the activities of Lancelot Andrews to try as accurately as possible to translate the word of God into English for the benefit of men's immortal souls, the struggle for the new constitutional arrangements to govern our lives on this earth had begun. Principles, which we now take for granted, were not established beyond argument during those 7 years. Some of them had still to be fought over, but the ferment of ideas represented ideas whose time had come. Our constitution is not fixed. It retains an element of flexibility. But I suggest that whenever we consider it or consider changing it, we are unconsciously, at any rate, influenced by these early struggles. And so it is that in the first few years of the reign of James I, we were blessed by the authorized version of the Bible, and I believe we should simultaneously recognize that it was produced during a seminal period in the history of this country, which influences the way in which it is governed to this day, and the way in which we ourselves as a nation are content to be governed. From start to finish, the essential issue remained the same. Was the king above the law? The answer, eventually forged in conflict, is simple. In the words of Thomas Fuller, "Be ye never so high, the law is above you." Constitutional monarchy was established. Kings were not little gods. They played an important, indeed a crucial part, in our constitutional arrangements, but not above the law. And as John Locke was able to declare at the end of this same century, where law ends, tyranny begins. That remains true to this day. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, it falls to me to express on your behalf our thanks to Lord Judge for a wonderfully learned and witty lecture on such a crucially important subject. Those 7 years, what a spotlight for us this evening. For me, somewhat enhanced, I have to say, by the thought of the remains of James I lying there behind us in the Henry VII Chapel, just with Henry VII and Elizabeth of York, and the thought of the two side aisles of the Lady Chapel, one where he allowed his predecessor to be buried in a glorious tomb, just resting her coffin, Elizabeth's coffin, on that of her half-sister there in the south aisle of the Lady Chapel. The glorious tomb somewhat outgloried by the tomb in the north aisle of his mother. James I contributed immensely to the shape and style of the Lady Chapel and its aisles, as it seems he contributed strongly to the ultimate death in 1649 of his son. But we celebrate tonight his achievement over the authorized version, and no doubt all of us, as we listen to Lord Judge, will have been thinking not only of the impact of those 7 years and the key decisions being taken then on the succeeding years, but as he implied at the end, in our own day, and the implications are immense and fascinating. It would be impertinent of me to seek to draw them out, but But I simply conclude by expressing once again, Lord Judge, our immensely strong thanks for your wonderful lecture. Thank you very much.